Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Belva Davis, a broadcast journalist, and I will be your moderator tonight. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series. It's underwritten by the Bernard Osha Foundation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest. Reverend Cecil Williams, founder and minister of Glide Memorial United Methodist Church, and Janice Mirkatani, founding president of the Glide Foundation, who also happens to be married to Reverend Williams. They are co-authors of the new book, Beyond the Possible, 50 Years of Creating Radical Change in a Community Called Glide. Now let me tell you just a little bit more about the two of them. For almost half a century, the Reverend Cecil Williams' voice have reverberated around the world. He has been everything except conventional in his approach to church and in his approach to God. As we learned in Beyond the Possible, he has used his own suffering as a child to turn religious dogma upside down. Reverend Williams is a Texan by birth, a radical by choice, and a guiding light that has lit the darkest passages for those in recovery. For nearly half a century, he and his wife, poet and activist Janice Mirkatani, have pioneered programs to feed millions of hungry people, provide medical care, housing, legal counseling, child care, and what Glide is most famous for, an offering of unconditional love. Janice is a founding president of the Glide Foundation and was the second poet laureate for the city of San Francisco. For decades, she's raised the funds that have allowed Glide to stay at the forefront of almost all social movements, no matter how radical. Located at the cross-section between glitzy downtown San Francisco and the Tenderloin, one of the city's toughest neighborhoods, they have managed to bring celebrities, the socially and politically elite, to Glide's unusual Sunday service for decades. The most amazing thing of all that they've done, they walked on hot coals all of their life, but they've kept their 31-year marriage going. So,
it's a miracle.
So, welcome, Reverend Cecil Williams, and everybody calls you Cecil, so tonight I'll probably revert to what I do all the time.
Okay, that's fine.
And welcome to you, Janice.
Thank you.
Our wonderful poet and activist here. You know, in looking and trying to decide after having known you all through most of the many transitions and the many challenges you've faced, I sometimes say in introducing myself that I'm a person who never expected to live till I was 31. So here it is. The years went somewhere. I don't know why, but it was because of a beginning, and how at the beginning you never can see yourself accomplishing a lot. So I wonder, for the two of you, could you see yourself, you know, nearly 50 years later, still at Glide, still inventing programs, and still counseling people?
You want to go first?
No, you go first.
I'll go first. I didn't think that I would live to be 40, Belva, and now that I'm 42, actually, I wouldn't even get close to a church. You couldn't catch me dead two blocks from a church. When I first started working at Glide, I taught school for a couple of years, and I was working my way through graduate school, and a friend of mine said there's a job, a temp job at Glide Foundation, and I said, okay, and signed on and met this guy who was pretty wild. And it was a...
Want to say that again?
It's pretty wild. And he was doing things at a church that I didn't ever think would be possible. And I said, wow, I think that's a place where I'd like to stay around and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reverend Williams, did you ever even think about what 50 years in the future would look like for you?
Yeah, I did, because that's the way my thinking goes. I use my imagination a lot, and I imagine what things can be like, and then I go after what things may be like. And so, using my imagination, I always thought that I would, of course, be around for a long time. And also, I wanted to be around because I didn't want to miss anything. I don't care what it was, I didn't want to miss it. I wanted to be involved in everything that I thought had possibilities of whatever. And it grew on me. It became a part of my life. I'm 83 years old now. And some people say, you don't look like you're 83, but I feel like I'm 83. You know, don't tell me. But I get very excited about where I am now with being 83 and doing some of the things that I like to do and will continue to do. And so I thought I was going to be around a long time. Yeah, sure did.
That's the difference between him and me, of course.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's a basic difference there.
Yeah. The perpetual optimist, very confident, and me being perpetually pessimistic. And, always having to fight. Yeah.
Your history in Texas, it was a tough time for you growing up. Were there seeds planted early on that said you were special?
Sure. Several I think about. One, in the book, which is an episode that really turned me around, was I had a breakdown when I was 12 years old. And I just went out of my head. That's all I can say, that it was something. And, of course, in San Angelo, we didn't have but two doctors, and they didn't understand psychological stuff that much anyway, nor did they do anything but just tell my parents and my brothers and my sister, just put the boy in the bed and let him rest. And we'll just see how he goes along. And that's exactly what happened. I went along and long and long for 1 year. And that breakdown really did several things for me. Number one, I have high amounts of energy. I have to cool it a little bit. Well, number one. Number two, I have a perception of people. I can easily make friends with people, or I can easily make mad with people. So I'm not sure which one is better or which one works best. But there's a sense by which I really can see people and get to know people and get to be with people. And I think the third thing has to do with not being afraid of death. Those three things. I came out of this breakdown that I had that began to work with me, and I began to work with them, and they helped me to look not only at the present but the future. And not that I was able to read the future, I'm not talking about that, but just the fact that I could go into the future and know that I could be there as a person and engaged in whatever I needed to engage in, and that I could make it count. And that's exactly what I've tried to do.
Janice, you called yourself a minute ago, you said a pessimist. So here you are with this optimist who's imagining whatever it is that's crossing his mind. How did you adjust to that and become so wedded to Glide? And I don't mean in the sense of...
No, I know. I mean, we worked together for 15 years before we got married. Mm-hmm. And he married me and my first husband.
It was the worst wedding I'd ever performed.
Yeah. But I would say that, yes, what? Yes, you want to follow up on your joke?
No, go right ahead, I'll stop. I just think, Jan, that I should have known that I would finally catch you one of these days. Anyway.
You have to read the book, because the first time I met him, he sat on the corner of my desk, and I was a temp worker. I was transcribing tapes from the LGBTQ community about police harassment against them for being gay. And he sat on the corner of my desk and he said, "Don't you know who I am?" And I said, "Nope." And he walked away and didn't speak to me for 2 weeks. And so I said to the staff, "Who's the guy with the ego?" And they said, "Oh, you met Cecil." Anyway. I came up from a past which was quite different from Cecil's, and I think that as he had a family and a community that really, really gathered around him in his times of turmoil and trouble, that I had a family that was almost the opposite, because I was incested by a number of males and adult males in my family. And I felt like the only way I could survive was to disappear. So I learned very early on how to escape my body, how to run away from situations and just hide and, you know, and just hope that something would save me, and not feeling worthy of being saved. So in that sense, it's a very unlikely match, because very confident guy, very, very talkative. I was talkative. Did I say talkative?
Yeah, you said talkative.
I said talkative.
Yeah, no.
There's another term for that. But and I was quiet and very silent, and I would not speak because I was afraid. And I felt invisible, and I felt voiceless. So, again, when I met this guy, and I saw the things that he was doing to welcome everybody into the church, into this church, I said, "Let me stick around. Let me see what happens here." And he was doing very wild things, like letting the first hookers convention have its meeting in the sanctuary of God. And of course, the first community that I worked with was the young gay community, who were runaways, who were also rejected by their families, who were also, you know, cast out of their homes for being gay, and who were also rejected by the church because of who they were. So this is falling off my ear, but they were my first messengers, and they were my first mirrors, and I would say that they probably helped me on my journey to begin to save my own life.
Yeah. One other question is, how, under your leadership, did you remain a Methodist minister?
Good question, Bob.
Well, that's a good question. But I remained a Methodist minister because the Methodists didn't want me. And if you don't want me, I'm after you. That's what I'm looking for. When I feel like I'm rejected, or I'm put down, or I'm told I can't do it, or whatever negative occurrences take place, I'm going to find ways then to break through and break down whatever it is that's holding us back. And I'm willing to risk my just being open and looking at things when things occur. I'm willing to change, even if I have to change. We do a lot of...
To change?
Yeah.
Are we recording this?
Okay, you got that one. The thing that works, it seems to me, is that the Methodists, I was one of the first graduates of Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University, one of the first African-American graduates. And I knew I was onto something, because when the students invited me to come to SMU and the faculty, I went and looked at things and decided that this was a good thing to do, to be one of the first. So there were five of us African-American fellows who went to SMU and Perkins and began to go to school there. And after 3 years, we graduated, of course. But challenges often occur, and I like that very much so. So I've stayed with it because of one thing. I wanted to change the Methodist Church. And it's very interesting. This last week, the Methodist Church put out an article on us. Up to last week, most of it's been very negative through the years. I mean, the Southerners, ministers of the Methodist Church, came out to San Francisco, tried to get my bishop, who was white, to expel me, to kick me out. And he said that man is now the son. He's my minister. He's the son of me, of myself, and therefore you cannot. He will not leave because he's turning the church upside down, and that's what we need. Well, that's all the bishop had to say, because I really went wild then, you know, no doubt about it.
We say, but my question had the deeper meaning, because we're going to get into some of the things that happened over those years, and you were constantly being tested and tried in various arenas about connection to the church and how it was run and so forth. But you did some pretty, I hate to keep using this word radical. I mean, you did things, you changed the sanctuary.
Yeah.
I remember when I walked in and saw it myself.
No cross.
No cross.
Yeah, we took it down. Sure did. And it became one of the most important symbols. Because what we were saying is, if the cross means death, then we're not interested in death. We're interested in life. If the cross can mean life, if we could get the cross to come down from the walls of our places, our churches, out of the sanctuary, into the midst of the people. The cross needs to be with the people, where there's real suffering and hurt and pain, and people going through all kinds of difficult situations where they are less than, and they are hurting, and they have great need. And the cross needs to go where the need is. And that means taking them off the wall, just like statues. They need to come off the wall. It all needs to come off the wall and be in the midst of the people. And that's what we did. We made this occurrence take place. I told people who were taking the cross down, take it down, take a month to get it down. Just take it down small pieces. Because this was a huge cross, but I wanted the people to experience the cross being chipped away and life being chipped away rather than life being given. And so it worked. I mean, well, it worked for some folks, but it didn't work for the Methodists and a lot of other folks. Some folks still. More caught up in the cross than they are themselves and life.
And when he was doing that, Bill, what was very symbolic for me was that, I realized, I think, even back then, that women are taught to be dependent on someone else giving them their sense of worth. I mean, even when I went to college, my mother said, you have to get a scholarship to college, because they couldn't afford to send me to college, even though they sent my brother to college. Never mind. that it was there that I would find a good man to marry, to define me. And I realized in many ways how we have been created, how we have been taught or programmed to be dependent on a greater force than ourselves, as women to be dependent upon a man, as Christians to be dependent upon God to change our lives. And really what this revolutionary act of taking down the cross was to say, no, you need to be in your own power. You need to take the responsibility to change the world. God cannot do this for you. And God cannot determine your life for you. You must determine for yourself your own destiny. And I think that was an amazingly metaphoric message to not only myself, but to many, many, many people who had felt so rejected by and judged by the cross. Judged to feel sinful, judged to feel that that Jesus Christ had sacrificed himself for us. And I think it was a very liberating thing to do. To liberate the cross from the wall was to say, you are liberated. To practice the love that that perhaps Christ brought to the cross, the unconditional love that that symbolizes among the people who are suffering.
Did early on you talk about that your own struggles as a child? Was that part of the charm, or I don't know if you call it the charm, the magnet that drew people to you because you had experienced this breakdown so early in life and had blossomed into the person they were talking to then, and you'd overcome that?
Well, I had to talk. I mean, to be able to say that to people. And this is why, at Glide, storytelling is critical. We must be able to tell our stories. And our stories are really truthful when we say who we really are, rather than pretend or act like we think we are better than somebody or that they are less than we are, or whatever the case might be. The important thing, though, is to know that I am who I am. And so for things to take place, it seems to me, Melba, it's always important to be in motion, to always have something that you interact with, which brings about significant change. And so that's part of what we do and what we've done through the years, is to find that the church needs to, and the community and the people need to vibrate. This is why we worked so hard to empower people. The people that have been empowered at Glide are just unmeasurable, unbelievable. I mean, person after person and community after community and every kind of person. When you read that book, you will see there is no place in America on Sunday morning that has the kinds of folks that we have. It's everybody in the world, all kinds of folks, Germany, France, Japan, you name South America. Countries come from all walks of life. People come from all walks of life, interspersed with the poor, with the have-nots, with people who are very rich, bringing their kids. It's a conglomeration of just really people finding their way to a magnet where they come and in many cases find something that, for instance, we've had people who have come before they went to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, said, "We're coming by Glide." And then after they get a Glide at 9 or 11, some of them change their minds. I'm not saying they all do, but some change their minds. The important thing, though, is to make sure that we are people who will take on almost anything, anybody, at any given time. We have still radicals at Glide and conservatives at Glide. We got Republicans at Glide, and that's something. But anyway, and when you get Democrats and Republicans together, you know, that's something right there, to tell you the truth. But the important thing is we don't go by it. We're not concerned about titles. Titles are not the important thing. People. We are the most important thing. So that's what works, and that's what seemingly lifts us into new relationships with each other.
And I guess the other thing are the programs.
Oh, my God.
These were conceived by you, just fed by you with your energy and organization, or you have so many. So.
Well, I think, Velva, the reason why Glide is so strange is that we build programs based upon the needs of the people. So we saw hunger as a very basic and first need, and that's the first program we created with no money. In fact, most of our programs started with no money. We don't determine programs according to funders or funding because we feel that that's what enchains us or that's what controls us. And so the food program started out as a volunteer program, potluck dinner brought in by about 10 volunteers to feed 50 people one night a week, and now we've grown to a program that feeds almost 1 million meals a year, and we've been doing that for 30 years. But that, again, was started because of the need. The children's program started because Joyce Hayes and I saw these children running the streets, and they were truant, and they were latchkey kids, and you know, their parents were not home. They were like in shelters, and we said we need a space where safety can be provided to children, and some of their needs like tutoring and caring for and after school programs. We went out and bought books on our own small salaries and created the children's program. And it kind of grew like that. The crack cocaine crisis, which was a scourge of the African American community, as you know, during the 80s, during the late 70s and 80s, the addicts came to us and said, AA doesn't work for us. You know, there are traditional recovery programs that don't fit our needs, or they don't feel welcoming to us. We need a program. We need for you all to start a program. And recovery became a real baseline program for all of our programs, because we feel that is out of our truths and out of our stories about what our shame, what our addictions, what our problems, what our difficulties, what the things that we don't want to reveal ourselves about. We are able to tell those stories. We're able to tell the truth. And that has been the tenet for many, many, many of our programs, including our clinic, which is not just primary care, but also mental health care, including all of the recovery programs around violence and violence prevention, and our men's violence abatement program. I mean, all of these programs have grown out of the needs of the people.
We
had to provide, I would say I'll take responsibility for providing the infrastructure for the programs.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
We were ready to, like, implode.
I know you started not wanting to accept government grants, and one of the questions that I got here was, how do you survive? Do you accept government grants? Or what keeps GLAD
Because
going?
Of the clinic, we do get government grants, and there are a couple of other programs where we do get government grants, and of course the city helps support a portion, a very small portion of our meals program. But I would say about 33% of our funding comes from government. Mm-hmm. So, and we try very much, very hard to diversify our funding because, well, those of you who know about diversifying and the importance of that understand that you should not be dependent upon any one particular source. And we don't like to be controlled by the buck.
So let's go to the glamour part, the part that the media latched onto, and that were the unusual programs and things that you did on Sunday morning and in the service that attracted celebrities and politicians and world leaders and all of that. When did you feel, Reverend Williams, that what you were saying would have an attraction not only for the people you're trying to help because they're down and out and need your guidance and your help, but these other folks would come in and sometimes fill the sanctuary?
Yeah. Well, there's a chapter in the book called Fame. That is an ordeal, because that's the time that I lost it. When you get Sammy Davis Jr., Bill Cosby, you just name it. You can go down the list of famous people in the entertainment industry, politicians. In fact, we just heard from politicians today about something. But you name it. People who hold positions. Bill Clinton and his wife came by when he was running, before even he began to run, or by the time he got ready to run. And when he was running, he at least came to GLAD three different times, and one time brought his daughter with him. His wife, what's
Hillary.
Her name? Hillary, thank you. Hillary came by at least three times, and maybe four. But anyway, you name whatever personality, Angela Davis, Huey Newton, you name them. They all have touched GLAD one way or the other. And when you have that going for you, and you're able to get people who very in regards to position and climate and concern and action and whether they are radical or not radical, etc., etc., you begin to lose it. At least I did. And I lost quite a bit. And if it hadn't been for Jan, I'm not sure where I would have been. But she kept reminding me who I was. And who I was, she would tell me, and it hurt. And some of it, that's why I call this book. This book is about running. It's about running away from slavery. It's about running away from what keeps us down and out and exposed. It's about what takes us and flips us over and flips us into being inhuman and being denied our fullness as human beings. To have all that take place and know that you can do it and most of them can't do it. And I saw you also as we passed by when you were holding the microphone or you were getting information from people all around the world and all around the country, you know. We passed each other. We saw each other. We greeted each other. But it was just the impact of this diverse group of folks that we were able to, that I was able mainly to move on, which Janice said, no, you cannot. You will not. Not when I'm on watch. You can't. And I said, okay.
Thank you.
But it took me some time.
You didn't say okay.
Eventually.
No. What I said was, help.
Well, what I said to Cecil was that in this country, I think that people go first, especially if you are a person of color, to sex or money. And the scandal which is found in sex or money. And I said, you know, you got to watch it because you got a whole lot of groupies. We have a whole lot of scrutiny. And you cannot compete with God. The mission is not for you to be greater than God, to be brighter than God, but rather to open the door so that people could find their own entrance to their meeting God. Or the spirit, or whatever name anyone here gives God. I like to say spirituality. But certainly he opened the door for me, and I could see the greatness and the beyond the possible greatness of this man to open the door for people to find their own relationship with whatever God or spirit they needed to define for themselves. And his belief in me led me to understand that it is truly the belief of the community and the support of a beloved community that would indeed save lives.
Reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. Our guests are Reverend Cecil Williams and Janice Mirakatani, who are discussing the amazing institution that is Glide Memorial Church, as well as their own stories of personal and professional success. And we have not talked a lot about you and your roots and what made you the kind of person that became the perfect companion for this gentleman here.
Who would have thought it? Who would have thought it? I was born in Stockton, California, and a year later we were incarcerated in 10 different concentration camps throughout the United States as Japanese Americans. Didn't matter that we were American citizens, most of us were American citizens, didn't matter that 50% of us were children. I don't have memory of the camps, but my mother maintained her silence about that history for 40 years. And it was that silence which I internalized, which created my sense of invisibility. It was also the sexual abuse, that sense of shame that I think for many of us or many individuals is the real killer. Shame is the source of our killing ourselves, I think, from my perspective. And when I came to Glide and I met this guy who was just kind of out there, and at first, you know, just big old ego sitting on my desk, that when I got to know him as a person, that he truly listened, he truly believed in me, he let me know that he loved me, he let me know that he could love me unconditionally, that he accepted me, no matter how I felt about myself, that I was visible to him. Now, he may have been interested in me, I don't know that.
Well, you won't be to marry us here.
But because, you know, of my background, I said to Cecil that I really want to work with you. I really want to help us develop this vision that you have and that I have been awakened to because of his work with the civil rights movement. My work then began with the Asian community. And we began to share that vision for, you know, justice, for social justice. And as co-workers, I said, you know, I just can't deal with an intimate relationship because of my own difficulties. So we vowed that we were going to work together and really create a place that was not based upon conditions, you know, the condition of whatever in terms of what might define a partnership. And as I said, he married me and my first husband and baptized my child. And I was divorced for 8 years. He was divorced for 5 years before we decided to get married. We were very, very, you know, marriage shy, should we say? But I think that what happened was a transformational process for me. I can't speak for him, but I would say that he changed quite a bit himself.
Sure did, and it hurt too. I mean, you know, here I am, a black man who's really in the forefront, and I've got to be out there. There's no doubt about it. And I'm told that I have to cool it. No, how do you cool it when you're hot? But you want to say something? Because I want to say, you know what I was going to talk about? Can we talk about the episode with the psychiatrist?
Go ahead. You go ahead.
Yeah, okay.
Because you tell it.
We had been going through quite a bit. And by the way, we went through quite a bit to find our way with each other. But we've been going through quite a bit, and we decided what we needed was therapy. So let's give it a try. So we selected an Asian therapist and African-American therapist. Asian woman, male, black, Afro-American man. They came, we went to their offices, and both of us were very angry, and I was extremely angry, I'm sure. And we started out with the session, right? And the more we participated in the session, we could see that we better let them really know what we were feeling. And we said, well, you know, what we really are feeling is that we're thinking about a divorce. And the African man said, no, you can't get a divorce. No way in the world can you get a divorce. What would the people think? What do we care about what the people think? We're here to find out what we think, you know. And then we kept going on, and finally we just got up and said, look, you need us to take care of you. So we left them. I haven't seen them since.
Well, there are so many stories that I don't know how you fit to even the way you condense these very important periods in the history of this city, the life of this city, life of this country, everything from the Vietnam War to the, you know, the flower children, the rock days, moving into gay rights, Black Panther Party, the Communist Party. Everybody wanted a piece of the action at GLIDE. How did you decide from one cause to the next? I mean, you were very involved with Angela Davis. And I guess, well, I don't want to put too much on you, but how did you decide what to take on? And was it the magnitude of the person asking you, or just you're looking out at the horizon and saying, this is something Glad has to do?
I would say that the issues that moved us,
mm-hmm.
and I would say that GLIDE is about movements, were those that were instilled or like ensconced in social justice issues. So when Angela was fired and when she was persecuted because of her relationship with George Jackson and because of her affiliation with the Communist Party, we saw that as an incredible injustice. And we can name, you know, group after group, the Panthers, the Los Siete, the Latin group, the Asian American cause for redress, the persecution of the gangs and the Chinese in Chinatown. I mean, these were all causes. I mean, the International Hotel, the eviction of the elderly. These were all causes that were very much compelling to our own heart, to our own vision, and I think to our own sense of, well, this is not right. You know, when we were in the when my mother would not speak about the camps, I said, well, wasn't there an uprising in the community? Didn't people stand for you and say this was wrong? And the fact is that they were pretty much, you know, other than their neighbors and friends, they were pretty much, it was just let go. And, you know, I think that injustice in, I mean, I think the worst injustice that we can commit as a people, as a community, is indifference. To do nothing. You know, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but to do nothing when you know that there is a very, very strong sense of wrong that is being done to any kind, any people. And I believe that that's what moved us into it. And of course, Angela calling Cecil and asking him to be her spiritual advisor, I mean, how do you say no to that, right? And Mrs. Jackson, Georgia Jackson, who is the mother of Jonathan and George Jackson, when she looked at her son, who was murdered by the police inside the prison, and her son Jonathan is also murdered or killed, her wail was, her cry was the essential, I don't know, the basic cry of all mothers of the world who lose their children to war, to violence, to injustice, to whatever circumstance. But to lose your child, I mean, this was, it was very compelling.
We have to put that in a little bit of context. That was all a result of the shootout at the San Rafael County
yes,
courthouse, and
right.
Several people were killed, and it was an internationally famous case, as well as the death of George Jackson,
right.
Later inside of San Quentin.
Let's see if I can help us just a minute here, because on the other hand, when the African-American man that was beaten by the cops in Los Angeles,
Rodney King,
when Rodney King's episode took place, of course, riots began in a number of communities. There was a group in San Francisco of over 3,000 people who left the certain area in the Mission and came up Market Street and came down Taylor, which is right next to Glide. And I mean, they were ready. They were really ready. And so
to
I had...
To destroy property and...
Yeah, to destroy property, very much so. Coming right in the heart of the city here to destroy property. And I was standing outside with some of our people and deciding what I needed to do. And all of a sudden, my son said to me, get up and talk to them, Dad. Talk to them. And before I made that decision, the captain who was leading the officers, the police, to deal with the situation, beckoned to me and said, Reverend, come here. So I went over to where he was, and he said, help us. And my son had already said to me, do something. And I got up on a truck right in front of Glide. I'll never forget. I don't even know whose truck that was. But I got up on the truck. and I began to speak to them. And after about 15 minutes, close to three-fourths of them decided to go inside Glide. And we went inside Glide and began to talk things through. And we did it. 2 days and two nights, we stayed there talking. And it worked. Again, we didn't many times decide on whether it was the police department or somebody else who was in need. It just took place, Melva. A lot of it just took place, just happened. And basically, our genuine, I think, our concern was save the people, or putting it another way, work with the people. And if you're against violence especially, then you have to work to combat violence. So that was a basic thing. Dealing with violence is not easy from any camp. So, but we were there, present for practically any group and every group dealing with violence.
There were movements of all types. Synanon, Est, on the other end, Jim Jones and People's Temple, and then there was Glide. There's now only Glide.
Yes, yes, and they called us in. Why don't you talk a little bit about what they...
Do I have to?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the leader of Est had called us in and said, you know, he was very interested in knowing why we continued to have an influx of people, because the church was growing. I mean, our community was growing bigger and bigger. And then they started talking about, and so he invited us over for dinner and to meet with his captains, his leadership. He shared his philosophy with us. This is Est. And I don't know, I can't remember what you said, but I said, that sounds like cultural genocide, because it was very controlling to me. I mean, that was my opinion. It was very controlling. It was very dogmatic. And I felt like this was not the way movements occur. Movements occur because they're for liberation and not for dogma. So that was one experience. The Synanon experience was a whole other unbelievable thing. We went to the center, which was at Badger, and we saw all these people at Synanon that were armed with rifles and, you know, major weapons. And then when we went to dinner, the women were separated from the men, and each table, as we started to gather, lowered a microphone so they could record what we were saying. And I'm going, oh my God. And so when we went into our room, I said, we were whispering, writing notes to each other, because we were certain we were being recorded. But those are just two little incidents.
Right. I wonder, Cecil, did you ever find a place of comfort with Jim Jones? Jim Jones, this man that led nearly 1,000 people to their death in the jungles of Guyana, who was here and a player on the political front.
Yeah, and had one of the best ways of manipulating folks that I've ever come across. I mean, anybody, any leader. The way that they maneuvered and the way they had things worked out and the way that they did things kept them always facing some kind of problem, but kept them also getting a lot of things that if we had known at that particular time, we would have been much more at least adapt to the situation itself. He called me and wanted to, when he came down this way, he wanted to settle in San Francisco. And I ran it down to him a little bit and said, well, here's what you're going to face. But it's a great city and this kind of thing. I went through that with him. And, of course, what happened was we did get to know each other. But I didn't get to know the real Jim Jones. And I think that was the crisis. Getting to know him, he did not want to be known, because he was definitely more concerned about the plight and predicament of what he could gain. And he used every method and invented some to make sure that it happened. When he got ready to leave to move to Guyana, he called me and said, "I'm leaving. I'm in trouble and I'm leaving. And what do you think?" And I said, "Yeah, I think you should stay here. If you're in trouble, you should stay here and work it out and get it worked out." And of course, he didn't stay. He said, "I got to go." And you know the rest of the story, of course, perhaps. He had it all worked out, the plans worked out, for them to participate in either killing themselves or having some of the people that supported him very strongly to kill everybody else who was left. So there were very few people that were left, of course. It was an episode that should not be repeated anywhere, nowhere. And I always felt that I could have done more, but it was not easy. It was not easy at all. That was one of the most difficult episodes that I went through, and that we went through, because he would call me at nighttime at 2 and 3 o'clock. I should have known then that there was a problem. And I knew it was a problem, but I didn't know what the magnitude of it was. But he was very difficult to deal with. And so
there was a question from someone in the audience saying, "Do you think it's possible for leaders of that type to emerge in today's society? And along with that, what impact has the new technologies had upon creating movements even?"
Yeah, and that's likely. It's likely. But at least there are those of us who will expose it. That those of us who are not afraid, we're not going to accept just anything taking place when it comes to how people are done in and how people are violently treated. And he had about 900 people, but he had a way of transporting them, of getting them to different places. And you would think that he would have had hundreds of thousands of people by the way he maneuvered the situation, but he had that all worked out. And before you know it, he would be in one place, and the next time he'd be in some other place, and it looked like, "Oh my God, these are a lot of folks." And what happened was when he decided that he had to deal with growth in his community, he would go to Detroit, where there were a lot of African Americans, New Orleans, where there were a lot of African Americans, wherever there were African, and he would go and try to get them to become a part of his plight and his situation. And he had a way of doing that. But the last year that he tried it, it didn't work. So he got hung up and began to really deal with things that were very destructive in his life and his people's life.
Well, I think it was the exposure to the abuse of young people that really put him over the edge. And I think he was close to the edge for quite a while.
There's no doubt about it.
And you ask about technology. I would say that one thing that I'm concerned about with technology, I mean, I'm a real dummy when it comes to technology, but what I can see is that there is a what we call the digital divide that is getting wider. And again, you know, the issue around classism and powerlessness is something that we should all be concerned about. Because as long as people feel powerless, then they're controllable. And I think that that always leaves the door open for people who would like to exploit that. I think we as a society should look always at those potential crises that divides people. And again, technology has created another kind of divide, which is for those who have or have knowledge and access and those who have not. So I would say that, you know, that's something I think we should be really mindful of.
Because teenagers seem to have
conquered the world.
come under the influence of their cell phones as much as under leaders of other sorts. A question, how did you befriend, this is totally different, but we're nearing the end of our time, and you know who I'm going to ask, how did you befriend Warren Buffett and get him to support what Glide is doing today?
Through his wife, Susie. Yeah,
that's right. That's what did it.
She. Susie,
go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Susie was a very, very dear friend, and she was truly an angel. She was, her heart was truly open to everybody, and she loved what Glide did. But she came to Glide for years before she exposed who she was. She didn't even, and she would not go by the name Buffett because she was fearful for her family being kidnapped or, you know, being held for ransom, etc. So she was very, very anonymous about who she was. But she kept coming back to Glide to make sure that we were real. And she introduced Warren to a Glide celebration. And he came in khakis, and he was, you know, like... and he said, you know what? After he experienced the celebration and experienced Cecil, he said, this guy is real. Glide is real. Warren is one of the most real people, I think, that we've met. He is... He won't give us money outright, contrary to a lot of people think, oh, you've got Warren Buffett, you got all the money. No. I think his joy comes from getting other people to contribute. And so he auctions himself off for lunch. And this evolved, of course, mm-hmm. through the friendship. But he auctions himself up for lunch and gets other people to bid to have lunch with him to give to Glide. So our last auction brought in $3.46 million.
And we're looking forward to the next one.
If anybody wants to bid, hey.
And that will be in June, the first week in June. Okay. So if anybody wants to bid, just let us know.
We're getting near the end of our time, Janice. We've not talked at all about you and your poetry and whatever feelings are left over from internment of your family. I don't know if we could accomplish something by just, if you have something there prepared to read that connect those things, internment, and your ability to capture it all in those wonderful words that you write. Well, I know you wrote a passage for your mom after she testified. I read
yes.
that, read it in the book, and it really was very, very moving.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure that that you...
I don't have that poem with me. I don't memorize my poetry. I can't remember anything, by the way.
She's wonderful.
But I would say that Breaking Silence, which is one of the major themes of my poetry, poetry has been always a source of voice for me, the source of finding... my own definition of self and authenticity. And when my mother broke her silence about the camp experience and she sent me her testimony, which was very brief, I called her and I had been weeping all day. And I said, Mom, why didn't you tell me you were going to testify? And she said, well, I just got mad. And I said, well, what angered you the most? I mean, what caused you to break your silence? She says, you know, spending 3.5 years in that damn barrack, that one room with my mother-in-law, made me so mad. I mean, never mind that they had to share latrines without walls. Never mind that they, you know, she lost her teeth in camp because she was nursing me, and they had no nutritious food in camp. Never mind that they had to walk for miles to go to the bathroom. It was her mother-in-law. But she did do a very beautiful testimony which conveyed the wrongs and the crimes of the government, which really set a new path of activism for myself. But I think a lot of inspiration for poetry comes through the lives of the people that we work with every day. Of course, comes from our history of internment. I believe that we owe it to our future generations to talk about past injustices, for us never to forget them so that we don't repeat them. And that my life with Cecil has been such a spiritual journey that I have a lot of poetry about Cecil. But thank you for asking, Bill. But next time I'll bring my book.
Well, as I said, a few minutes left. They're through the cards. Some concern are you concerned about the impact on the Tenderloin as more and more technology companies move closer and closer on Market Street and and we see San Francisco changing. What are your concerns for the poor that are still here, for those with addiction that are still here?
And they're going to be there. They're going to be there. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. No matter what is done and when it is done, there's always going to be that battle between what I call the haves and the have-nots. It's going to be there. What I hope will happen is that in the process, when we begin to look at what's going to happen between 8th Street and mm-hmm. what's the last street down here, the Embarcadero, that there will be areas that will be bring comfort and concern to people who are alienated and hurt, and people who are on the fringes of society, the poor, for instance, that we will take care of what we build and what we plan to make sure that our brothers and sisters, no matter who they are, no matter what they look like, no matter what they're going through, we'll always be concerned about them. And we will build locations and areas along that walk that will help them survive.
I do think that affordable housing is a real key issue here. And I think that companies that come in who have the money need to contribute to improve the quality of life for all people in the neighborhood. And the three buildings that we've built, that Glide has built, for homeless people and for working class families and for mentally ill individuals and for people who are suffering from AIDS, that has changed the community to become a more stable community. There have been positive changes, but we need so much more.
You really are going to have to read the book. We've only scratched the surface of the stories there. We didn't talk about the AIDS crisis, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and your roles in that, and so many other. We didn't talk about the fact that Glides has become the focus of spiritual life for many gay people, that your congregation is led by and supported 40, by.
Yeah, about 40%.
Yeah. So there's so much more to read. So we're glad that you wrote a book because people...
We're glad you wrote yours, Bill.
Oh. Yeah.
Thank you.
But the time has come, though, for that last question. There's always this one. And it says, Cecil, does God surprise you? And if so, what is one of your favorite God surprise stories?
At last, I can play God. I come from that bent, that cut of theological cloth that said God frees us. God does not tie us up and prevent us from growing and from being and from doing. God frees us and says, you're free, you're free, you're free. Now live your life. Live it fully. You don't have to worry. Take some of the guilt away. You're too guilty. I know this speaks to a lot of folks. And they get so guilty about, oh my God, I'm going through this, and I did this, and I did it. No. You're free. We are free. God says you're free. If God says we're free, then we're free to laugh. We're free to have fun. We're free to work through our stuff. We're free to stand up. We're free to be what we would like to become with people and with God. And that is to live our lives fully, fully. Take away all the stuff that would destroy life and bring it together, so we could live as human beings rather than as having some doctrine that designates that we got to do this or that, but a doctrine that says, I got to go because I want to be free also.
Our thanks to Reverend Cecil Williams, founder and minister of Glide Memorial United Methodist Church, and to Janice Mirakatani, founding president of the Glide Foundation. They are co-authors of the new book, Beyond the Possible, 50 Years of Creating Radical Change in a Community Called Glide. We also thank you, our audience. and those of you who are listening on radio, television, or the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And I also want to say to those who are sitting here to remind you that copies of Reverend Williams and Ms. Mirakatani's new book are on sale in the lobby, and they will be pleased to sign them for you just in the room just outside the door. We appreciate your letting them get through the audience here and make their way to where the books are at the signing table. And I would like to add, again, my personal thanks. It's been a pleasure sitting talking to the two of you about so much that you've done that has shaped what San Francisco is.
Thank you, Melvin.
Thank you, Melvin.
And now this meeting.
Thank you for being the pioneer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And 9/11, the celebration.
And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, concludes and is adjourned.